and one in Vancouver. Bombay Shot House, located at 804 Southwest 12th Avenue, provided dinner, serving traditional Indian dishes as well as vegetarian-friendly options.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Eco Plumber, providing sustainable plumbing services to Portland and the metro area, including remodels, repipes, and repair, as well as green projects such as rainwater or greywater harvesting, and alternative materials such as 100% VOC-free green pipe. Information at 503-342-8244 or eco-plumber.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon. That's 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this September 14th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we open the show with Bill Resnick interviewing independent journalist Eric Larson, who recently published the book The People's Pension, The War Against Social Security from Reagan to Obama. That's available from AK Press. They'll discuss how and why Social Security survived in the face of elite attacks. Since its inception, Larson is part of the movement seeking to expand Social Security, not just raising benefits, but involving recipients in the battle for a just economy. Jan Hocken talks with Old Mole Patsy Kullberg about her new novel, Girl in the River. The novel, a work of historical fiction, centers on the struggles of a fictional working-class young woman finding her way in the actual world of corruption, vice squads, and abortion politics during World War II and its aftermath in Portland. Jan talks with Patsy about what reproductive rights activists might learn from this period in Portland's history and how novels contribute to our capacity to imagine that a better world is possible. Jan Hocken returns to close today's show interviewing Red, an activist and representative of SWAP USA, Sex Workers Organizing Project. She is active with the Portland SWAP chapter and also director of a new outreach program in Portland for sex workers, STROLL. They talk about the recent position taken by Amnesty International calling for the decriminalization of prostitution and some of the controversy around this position. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KABU members, old and new, for supporting KABU and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we return to Bill Resnick and Eric Larson.
Eric Larson, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Eric Larson is an independent journalist who recently published a book in 2012 from AK Press, The People's Pension, The War Against Social Security from Reagan to Obama. Eric Larson, as your title suggests, Social Security has been under attack, especially by conservatives, but now even people who call themselves liberals. Tell us the story, the battle, why Social Security has survived all of the attacks over the years.
There's a lot of different periods in the battle over Social Security, going back, of course, to the passage of the Social Security Act of 1935, which was immediately met very much as Obamacare was decades later by lawsuits all the way up to the Supreme Court trying to get it declared unconstitutional. That didn't work. There was a period of decades where Social Security was accepted by Republicans in a more or less uneasy truce. And then that began to change in the late 70s, early 80s. And there are stages. Initially, the effort was made on the right, and this was funded really by the right-wing endowments, the Scaife family, the Pew Trusts, and so forth. It was a sort of an ideological battle to prove to the American people that Social Security was going bankrupt and that in order to save the program, we had to destroy it effectively. That gave way in the 90s to a more bipartisan effort, which included a lot of what I would regard as center-right Democrats, the Mark Warners and the Jim Colbys of the world in Congress.
And Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton really cooperated with the whole thing and was key to it.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. Clinton appointed a commission to study Social Security in the mid-90s that came up with a divided report, three different sets of recommendations, two of which included carving out private accounts. And that was a watershed. That made huge headlines, and all of a sudden the idea of partially privatizing Social Security became a big topic on Capitol Hill. And Clinton himself, just before the Lewinsky scandal really hit its height, attempted in collaboration with Newt Gingrich, supposedly his ideological enemy, on an effort to create a plan that would cut Social Security severely and create private accounts on the side so they could sort of claim, well, this isn't privatization, we're just, quote-unquote, rationalizing Social Security and we're giving you the opportunity to save more on the side. But really, it was kind of a backdoor privatization plan. That effort was scuttled by the Lewinsky scandal and the impeachment proceedings, but it's a testimony to how powerful these bad ideas can be in Washington that Clinton and Gingrich were working behind the scenes to try and get that plan considered. These bad ideas have a tough time dying in Washington. The real shift that we've seen in recent years began in 2005, though, when George W. Bush was president. He tried to push a privatization plan, his 60 Cities in 60 Days tour, where he literally was traveling the country proselytizing for the idea. It was a huge flop. It destroyed him in the polls as far as domestic policy went. Since then, there's still been a lot of interest in Washington in cutting Social Security. The private account idea hasn't been as prominent because Bush kind of spoiled that for a lot of people. But essentially, in the primaries right now, rather in the lead-up to the primaries, you're seeing a lot of discussion among Republicans, again bringing up the idea that we need to cut Social Security in order to save it. So the idea is still live, it's still very popular, and there's still a lot of Democrats in the center-right portion of the party who are eager to collaborate with them if they get a chance.
It seems to me also the mechanism they're going to use to destroy Social Security has somewhat changed from privatization, although that'll be part of it, and they'll keep trying to do that. The financial community really wants to get their hands on that money. But it seems to me what could have gone through and has a really good chance is, one, to raise the age a lot, and two, to change the cost of living, the COLA, the cost of living adjustment.
The raising the age is an idea that's been around for a long time, and it's getting repeated constantly now. And what that really comes down to is gradually raising the age at which you can collect full Social Security based on the idea that on average the population is living longer, so we shouldn't be using Social Security to subsidize a longer and longer period in retirement. The problem with that is that there are an awful lot of people who work in very physically demanding jobs and don't stand to collect a whole lot of Social Security. And so there are an awful lot of people who would be very badly damaged by a higher retirement age.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Eric Larson, who did a book and published in 2012, The People's Pension, The War Against Social Security from Reagan to Obama. Eric Larson, let's talk about one of their most powerful arguments, saying, well, Social Security can't last. You younger people will never get anything, but you're paying a lot of money into it, so you've got to be against it. Respond to that argument.
To put it in a nutshell, there's a huge irony here, Bill, which is that younger people are the ones who are really going to need Social Security when they get into their later years, because we have seen private pensions slowly disintegrate in this country to be replaced by unreliable 401k plans. We've seen public pensions under attack, heavily under attack these days. Job security is a thing of the past. So there's actually not that much support for cutting Social Security among the young. And one reason, again, is that they're the ones who are going to need the system more than anybody presently.
Eric Larson, a lot of people now are trying to go on the offensive instead of being constantly on the defensive on Social Security and trying to save it, which has been successful because, in fact, there are so many people who recognize deep in their bones that Social Security is the last line of defense against absolute destitution. How can we work in current struggles to go on the offensive instead of being constantly defending?
First of all, I think you're absolutely right, Bill, that that's what we have to do. Is if we're going to defend these systems, if we're going to make them continue to work for future generations, even for older workers today, we've got to go on the offensive. And so it's very encouraging to me, for example, to see some of the more progressive members of Congress talking about expanding the program, making benefits more generous, and especially making the system work better for people such as caregivers, people who are, you know, the sandwich generation, who are bringing up kids and taking care of elderly relatives as well. Those are very important initiatives. The reality is that the war against Social Security has kept the program in a sort of a state of suspended animation for the better part of 40 years. The last time it was improved in a major way was in the early 70s. It does need to be improved to meet the needs of people today, particularly given wage stagnation. Now, the reality is this, I think this is a larger issue, is that the New Deal programs were very successful and very popular, including Social Security. But they really were very sort of top-down bureaucratic programs, which made them very vulnerable to attack starting in the Reagan era. You know, big government, oh yeah, it's set up to help you, but it's big government, it's not answerable to you, you don't have any input in how it's run. Would it be nice, for example, to have your own private Social Security accounts? All of a sudden it looks very good to people. The way to counter that is that really we need to think about how a left political strategy can move beyond simply defending the New Deal, which was really not that radical a program to begin with. And one of the things that we need to think about is increasing the sense of ownership of these programs. There's a sense in which people feel like Social Security is not something they own, even though they pay into it and support it. It's something up there that somehow sends them checks every month, and that it's a nice thing, but they don't understand it. They don't really feel as though it's something they own. But in fact, they do. Social Security has a trust fund, which means that it's held in trust for the people who pay into it and get benefits out of it. There is an argument to be made, I think, for democratizing Social Security, for making the system, for example, the trustees of Social Security, perhaps they should be elected by the people who pay into the system.
Right. You're talking about sort of a collective ownership by the people, and that gives them much more control of how the funds are invested, how they're used.
Yeah, I actually, let me respond first of all with a really quick anecdote. During the 2000 election, when George W. Bush was running against Al Gore, they had an exchange during one of their debates in which Bush said, Social Security is something you own, it belongs to you. And Al Gore said, well, gee, this shows how ignorant George W. Bush is. He doesn't understand that Social Security is a government program. And he got some good laughs on the basis of that. But in a weird way, Bush was more right than Gore was. Social Security isn't just a government program. And part of the loyalty that people have to it is the fact that they feel as though they have earned it. They paid their money in. They're getting the benefits out. The problem is that they don't feel like it's something they control. And I think that the answer to the appeal of private accounts that you own personally is to restore this idea of collective ownership, that collectively we do own Social Security. And there's a number of ways to do that. One is, for example, shouldn't we perhaps elect the people who are the trustees, which gives us an opportunity to debate the issues around Social Security in a better way. Secondly, we can think about how is the trust fund money collected. This is the largest pool of investment money in the world. And how do we invest it? Do we use it for economic development? Do we use it for housing for the elderly? Do we use it for things that actually help to achieve Social Security's goals of greater security for workers and retirees? Social Security money doesn't have to just sit there in treasury bonds. If we were going to use it for something else, we need a mechanism which make sure that it's used for the things that it ought to be and that democratizes it so that people feel as though this is something here that belongs to them.
All right, this is Pear, and I am here with Justin, and we are here to announce a thrilling bit of news that this is a matching period for the Old Mole Variety Hour from 9 to 10 p.m. You can double the impact of your donation right now. An anonymous donor has made a generous offer to match the next $500 in donations called in during the Old Mole Variety Hour. So double the impact of your gift by calling 877-500-5266.
That's right. It is Monday morning, and we are in the fall membership drive, and it is destination programming here with Old Mole Variety Hour. You rely on this kind of programming, and you get it no place else, and we're hoping you will pick up your phone right now and dial 877-500-5266 to take advantage of this matching period. Your money gets doubled, and we've got a nice little goal for the Old Mole. We know we can do it. $1,000 between now and 10 a.m. Maybe 10 of you could do $100 a month by starting an ongoing sustaining membership of just $8.25 a month, and also that'll become $200. When you call right now, 877-500-5266.
Or go online. Go KBOO.FM and look in that little tip jar, pickle jar, kielbasa jar, whatever it is. And there, you just click on that and you will get easy instructions on how to make your payment get to us. We recommend the electronic funds transfer. It's very easy. You just sort of you sign up for it and you designate the amount. It's up to you how much you want to give every month. And it comes out of your your credit card, your debit card, your checking account. That's up to you also. And it happens every month automatically. You don't have to write out a check or lick a stamp or anything like that. It just all happens. All you do is keep track of it, and it keeps the funds coming in kind of throughout the year, and it makes everybody happier. And I want to thank Eva from Salem, who is a returning member. And she is a brand new monthly contributor. I guess she found out that the easy way to be a member and then stay a member is to do the electronic funds transfer. So that's what we recommend.
877-500-5266 to take advantage of this matching period. There are not many other sources where you get to consistently learn about the wholesale giveaway of American retirement to Wall Street, and that is important information to be getting out to the community. And the only way that happens at this vital community resource is because you, dear listeners in Radio Land, answer the call by making the call for over 23 million commercial free minutes. We're asking you to please do it again. Start a monthly contribution. Maybe you could do that $100 for the year. That's $8.25 a month. We're going to get out of the way here in just a second, hand it back to Old Mole. I want to remind you, the way the lights stay on, the way this vital programming gets out to the community is because the community makes it possible. And that money doesn't go away. It stands here as a monument at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. You can always check on it with your radio dial or by stopping in at any time. But in the meantime, make sure the lights are on and the doors are open and the services are continuing by calling right now toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Eric Larson, who wrote the book recently, in 2012, The People's Pension, The War Against Social Security from Reagan to Obama. We've been talking the last couple minutes about giving people a sense of sort of a collective ownership and a responsibility even to be engaged in how this fairly large pool of money is being invested and used. Eric Larson suggested that it could be used for lots of really good things like housing, and even it could be used to deal with the great climate crisis by investing in energy production in a renewable way by communities.
Yeah, as it is, if you want to look at it from sort of a 180-degree perspective, is that as it is, Social Security is invested in Treasury bonds. The money you pay in is invested in Treasury bonds and sits in a trust fund. That money is essentially used for all the different sorts of purposes the government uses money for, from restoring and rebuilding bridges to funding wars in the Middle East. Now, wouldn't it be interesting to consider whether that money could be used in more targeted ways that actually have something to do with the goals of the program, which is economic security for working people and the elderly? For example, as I mentioned, housing, maybe co-generational housing for the elderly and younger people. It could be used for local or even neighborhood level development projects, economic development projects that add to economic security. It could be used for projects that have to do with green energy, which creates a more affordable and renewable style of living for people all over the country.
Yeah, it could be used for transit systems. Transit for the poor in most places is terrible, and they cannot get around, and people who shouldn't be driving.
Absolutely. Transportation for the elderly is actually a big problem in this country. Even a lot of public transportation systems are not really geared towards them. That's something that could be invested in. The real point here is to get Social Security back to its origins in a way. Social Security started out as, it really comes from the idea of social insurance, which is the idea of working people collectively pooling their resources to obtain the things that they need. And that comes out of the 19th century idea of mutual aid, which was something that developed out of working class movements in Europe and in the United States. And what I think is really has to happen here is that Social Security needs to get back in a way to those radical origins, which is we will create a social system that works for us. We will do it independent of the capitalist system. We will do it in a way that meets our needs and that supports our communities, not just us as individual workers and households. That's the kind of thinking I think that we need to get back to with Social Security, and it'll promote a really radically different society in the long run. For workers to be able to take more control of Social Security is a way to prefigure that kind of society and to create something that really is new and that moves beyond the bureaucratic New Deal type of thinking about progressive institutions.
Eric Larson, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah, let's just mention your book again.
The book is The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan, and it's out from AK Press, and it is a history of the struggle to privatize Social Security and of the efforts by people in the progressive community to oppose those efforts successfully so far.
And it discusses, I understand in the epilogue, the road ahead for Social Security and how it can be a force for, a powerful force for democratizing the United States. Thanks again, Eric.
Thank you, Bill.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. That's Portland 90.7. Our first guest this morning with Bill Resnick was Eric Larson, discussing the survival of Social Security and the movement to expand it. And later on in the program, we'll hear Old Mole Jan Hocken and Red, director of the new outreach program in Portland for sex workers, STROL. They'll discuss the recent position taken by Amnesty International, calling for the decriminalization of prostitution. And also Jan Hocken will talk with our Old Mole Patsy Kohlberg about her new novel, Girl in a River, all of that coming up later in the program. But we're going to go back to Justin and Pear, who are going to tell us all the great things about KBOO and why you should renew or become a new member.
Well, there's so many things. Where do we begin? Start with the Old Mole Variety Hour, which has been on the air now for a long time for a very good reason. Because for years and years, it's presented a variety of news and information and music, all kinds of things you don't get anywhere else on the radio dial, you know. And it's KBOO has been doing this show now for quite a while, and we are now in a matching period. All you Old Mole fans out there, you can call in 877-500-5266, and your money, if you donate $10 a month or $50 a month, whatever it is, it will be doubled for this hour only. So do it now, 877-500-5266.
That's right. It's an easy time to get involved. And remember, we're not asking you to break the bank. And so when you make modest contributions of your hard-won monies, and you do that during a matching period, you get the effect of doubling your money without any more impact to you. You know, the average gift is around $100, between $90 and $100, I think, and so maybe $825 is the right amount every month for you to start your monthly contribution. Remember, we value all contributions, but the most convenient and powerful way to support KBOO is by starting that ongoing monthly contribution. contribution because it allows us to budget throughout the year, to see how much money is coming in, when to make capital improvements, et cetera, et cetera. It also means that you are always on target with your support of the mighty 90.7. 877-500-5266 is the number to call to take advantage of the matching period. 877-500-5266. If you could do $90 gift over the year, which would amount to, $7.50 a month, your gift will be doubled and we'll send you a copy of the 2016 Chinook book. There are about $7,000 worth of savings in there, so I dare say that's a reason to consider. 877-500-5266.
Well, I want to thank Norm from Southeast Portland, who is a renewing member. And I want to thank Jane from Northeast Portland, who's also a renewing member. They took advantage of this matching period, and they doubled their money. I don't know how much money they contributed, but whatever it is, it is doubled. If Donald Trump sent us a check for $50,000, that would become $100,000. But I don't think that's going to happen. Gee, Justin?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons that's not going to happen, but primarily because we're matching the first $500 pair.
Okay.
But,
we're not trying to
break the bank. But what we always try and remind people is we would much rather have thousands and thousands of supporters giving modestly than one person giving ginormously, because it's more sustainable and it's more spread out through the community. And we've been hearing this mantra for a long time, follow the money. What we're asking you to do is follow that money from your home right here to KBOO. There's nobody in between. It comes from the listeners to the service providers, and it's closing this loop. Please call right now, 877-500-5266. Of course, many people are listening all over the world at our website, kboo.fm, because they don't have a vital resource like KBOO in their terrestrial radio. So please, you can make that donation just at that website, kboo.fm. But if you're in North America, there's no music during membership drive better than the sound of ringing phones. Call us right now, 877-500-KBOO.
And you can follow your money right down here to 20 Southeast 8th, this modest little building with a mural on the wall, and come on in and see us. See where your money is going. You will see that we do not have a fancy operation. We have a working operation. We have people here working around the clock, bringing you all kinds of news, public affairs, good music, drama, all sorts of things. And it's all done by volunteers, people just like you, for you. This is the People's Radio Station, KBOO.FM. Give us a call at 877-500-5266. Take advantage of this double your money break.
Absolutely. And Perry, you make a really important point here. The public owns the airwaves, but that doesn't mean anything if the public doesn't have access to the airwaves. KBOO is ensuring the public nature of the airwaves, but there are less and less institutions like KBOO. And so it's really, really important to take a little bit of responsibility for the mighty 90.7. But let me also point out, when we say a little bit of responsibility, that's exactly what we mean. Let's imagine you were going to start a $60 annual gift by giving $5 a month. That would be 16 cents per day towards the $2,238 it costs every day to maintain your radio station. So when we ask you to take a little responsibility, we mean just that. Won't you call right now, 877-500-5266.
Or kboo.fm, click on the jar and donate that way, or come on down and see us at 20 Southeast 8th. We are here for you, and now we want you to be here for us. You can become part of this station as a member. You can run for the board. You certainly vote for the board. You can help run this station. It is your station, folks, and we want to keep it that way.
And it's a matching period right now, so while we hand it back to the Old Mole Variety Hour, we're asking you, please, take a moment out of your busy day and give us a call right now, toll free, 877-500-KBOO.
Thank you, Justin and Pear. We now turn to Old Mole's Jan Hocken and Patsy Kullberg discussing Patsy's newly published novel, Girl in the River. Jan?
Well, Patsy, it's delightful to have you on this side of the other mic this morning, rather than engineering behind the scenes. A number of reviewers have praised this book as a remarkable work of historical fiction and feminist fiction. For locals, it's of particular interest because it brings to life a little-known part of Portland's history. Some of this world that you create resonates with contemporary moral crusades around prostitution, abortion, vice squads and police raids. These are scenes that run through the novel. Could you say a little about what led you to write Girl on the River and to draw on this part of Portland's history from that reaches from the Depression era through the post-war period?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. This is great. The mid-20th century Portland is a really interesting and dynamic time, particularly in terms of the opportunities that were available for women and also the accepted concepts of a woman's role in private and public life. And so I was very interested in how a working class girl might negotiate that time. But in addition to that, there were two sort of larger than life characters, women, kind of in feminist terms, a bit ambiguous, both of them. One was Dr. Ruth Barnett, who was the Portland's most famous abortionist and a very flamboyant character and queen of Portland's nightlife. And then kind of at the opposite spectrum, you have a very staid lawyer who became Portland's first lady mayor, and she was also an anti-vice crusader. So it just seemed like a setup to explore a whole lot of different kinds of issues. So I plopped a girl in there and went for it.
Product of the feminist imaginary, as they say in cultural studies. So in your author's note, you say a bit about how a novelist works with historical material and approach the responsibility you carry to historical figures, many of whom have not been written up much. And so you carry a historian of women's
right.
work, as well as a novelist, you carry that responsibility pretty heavily. How did you work that boundary between fact and known facts
right.
and the fiction you created through these
right.
historical characters?
Well, I don't want to pretend that I came to it absent a perspective. I think that it goes without saying. On the other hand, you want to... you know, there's a verity in what happens, and you want to honor that. And you can't just kind of shove, you know, history into your personal political framework. So where it becomes most interesting, I think, is where the historical record is silent. And I encountered that with Mayor Dottie Duguid Lee. A name like that you really couldn't make up, I don't think, because she was actually silent on the issue of abortion, even though she presided over the police raids of all the abortion clinics, including Dr. Barnett's clinic in Portland. But it wasn't her idea, and I felt like I needed to imagine what she was thinking. So I tried to look into who she was. You know, she's very religious. She's barren, to use the word of the times.
For a childless woman.
Well, she has two adopted children. She's very, even though she's very conservative, she has a progressive view on the woman's condition. And she has a very progressive view on prostitution, for example, on sex work, relatively.
You can just say what... we'll be talking later in the hour
right.
about what is a progressive view, and there's no agreement, let me tell you, on what a progressive feminist view on prostitution is.
Well, exactly, and you won't find one in my book either. You know, you'll find some ways to think about it, maybe. But and so I was sort of stuck with trying to figure out what was she thinking? You know, she was out there conducting raids on everyone, but was leaving the abortionists alone until this reporter kind of pushed her into it. And then during the raids and after the raid, she was remarkably silent. She gave no, I could find no comment anywhere. I couldn't find anything in her personal papers, nothing. And so I kind of, you know, created kind of what I considered or what I thought would have been on her part a very ambivalent feeling about abortion in Portland at that time, which I thought was probably as likely as anything. And you know, so I did my best.
And there's both the maybe the way novels are driven by characters and how they fulfill what you set them up to do.
Exactly.
And so there are those kinds of considerations. But it seemed to me in reading the novel that you were working with something else that I found so riveting and interesting about the book, and that is to bring the complexity and moral ambivalence that is so hard to talk about in feminist politics, and maybe any politics in a way, where you have these counterpositions that just strip so many moral concerns of their complexity, because you're trying to strip it of all of the morality that conceals the politics. So you grant your characters complexity. But maybe let's talk about that a bit more with respect to abortion. What were you trying to say? I mean, you're also a doctor, medical doctor, so you've kind of familiar with some of this ground as well as an activist and a novelist. What were you trying to say about the history of abortion through this story?
Well, I think one thing is that it's a moral issue, but it's not simply a moral issue. And certainly on an individual level, I think a lot of people struggle with that. And some of the characters in the novel certainly struggle with that. And the way they either castigate themselves or do not, you know, for their involvement with it. But I think that the casting it as a moral issue is usually a disguise for the underlying politics, in that abortion rights or reproductive rights more generally have to fit in or are made to fit into a larger socio-political environment, and that, you know, they're used by the powers that be for certain political aims. And during that time, of course, it was easy to see we were entering into a Cold War with Russia, and we didn't need to have abortion was a little bit superfluous in that environment, in the sense that we didn't need to keep pregnant women workers women workers unpregnant so they could contribute to the war. And I mean, there were a lot of complexities, but it was clearly not morality.
During the war era, it was seen as kind of a practical necessity, you mean, for women?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then some of the moral campaigning around this followed the war.
Oh, yeah, it was all, and it was nationwide. It wasn't just here in Portland. There was a post-war crackdown on abortion rights.
You also challenge, I think, in a very interesting way through your characters. I don't want to say too much, because there is the pleasure of the discovery as these characters unfold. But you do challenge a refrain that's common in the abortion rights movement, that is overcoming the back alley, you know, challenging back alley abortions. Can you say a bit about the back alley abortion concept with respect to this doctor, Dr. Ruth Barnett, who is such a well-known Portland abortionist.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, the obvious thing is that it's back alley because it's pushed there. But in Portland...
But doesn't that imply kind of something about poor people, working class, the danger? And I think it evokes dangers for women and being stuck in an alley and the vulnerability of women. I mean, it kind of conjures up other dangers for women, as well as medically unsafe abortions.
Right. Well, sex is dangerous, and it's anarchic, as some people like to say, and you don't want to unleash it too much. But in Portland, abortions weren't in the back alley. You could get a safe abortion in Portland during this time, and that was largely credited to the standard that Ruth Barnett set for the community.
So that itself is worth a read, just right. Learning about her and this fascinating little-known part of Portland's history. Well, Girl in the River, novel by Patricia Kohlberg, is available at Wallace Books in Selwood and at Powell's Books downtown. It's also available online in both paperback and e-book editions through the publisher bygoneerabooks.com. Or through Powell's Books or Barnes & Noble. You can get the book as well or learn more about it through patriciakohlberg.com, the website. Thanks right. So much for being here.
Thank you, Jane.
Today and congratulations
Thank
on
you.
A fabulous piece of work.
Excellent, excellent. And you are getting this on the mighty 90.7 through the Old Mole Variety Hour during our fall membership drive. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Justin. I'm joined by Pear, and we're taking a brief moment out of the Old Mole to remind you that it is fall membership drive, and we're in the middle of a matching period. We have about 20 minutes more where your money will be doubled up to $500. And I was just looking, maybe we've sort of finished with that, because it looks to me like we only have $460 to go. Thank you for those who have called in. And you know what we could do? If 8 of you would start that modest contribution of $5 a month for a total of $60 in the year, that would take us over the goal. Remember, the real story is that we have a total membership drive goal of $95,000, and we're over $42,000 right now. So please call and take advantage of this matching period and say thank you to the Old Mole and the mighty 90.7. 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO.
Well, I want to thank some people who are taking advantage of this double your money period. I want to thank Tom from Northeast Portland, who is renewing. I want to thank Adele from Southeast Portland, who is a monthly contributor. I want to thank Kelly from Oregon City, who is renewing, starting monthly. EFT. And I want to thank Denise from Northeast Portland and Diana, who is giving an additional gift because she learns things when she listens to KBOO.
Isn't that marvelous?
This is her station. It is your station. This station belongs to all of us, and it's up to us to keep it going, because the Donald Trumps of the world are not going to keep it going for us. You can be sure of that.
I think you're right, Pear. 877-500-5266. Sometimes I hear my comrades on the air say, we need you to give. We need this. We need that. That doesn't seem right to me. The community needs KBOO, and we're not asking them to give something to us. We're asking them to, asking dear listeners to maintain the commons, the radio commons, the information commons. It adds to a vital community, and we're asking you to do that. 877-500-5266. Let's make sure that we go over goal for this program and that we get all that the community needs KBOO to have to continue doing it. You can do that online at KBOO.FM. I think we're going to get out of the way right now and give you some more Old Mole. We'll be back to check in with you. Thanks for everyone who has called and everyone who is moving to the phone and dialing 877-500-KBOO.
Well, welcome to KBOO Red.
Hi.
Last segment, shift gears here. In our last segment, Patsy Kohlberg brought us some of the history of Portland through her new novel. And part of that, her story centers on prostitution and the vice squad here in the city during the war and post-war years. Well, let's talk about some of what's going on now around prostitution in the city, and start with a bit about your organization. You are a member of Sex Workers Organizing Project, a national group that supports the recent position taken by Amnesty International calling for the decriminalization of prostitution.
Yeah.
Tell us first a little about Sex Workers Organizing Project, or SWOP, and what you try to do.
Sex Workers Outreach Project. So we try to do a lot of things. We mostly do outreach and education, so like street outreach programs that promote harm reduction, you know, like needle exchanges, condoms, free HIV testing kits, which is what my side organization agendas. But we also, you know, pay attention to the media, and we track mentions of sex work or prostitution in the media. And so that's why the amnesty deal is such a big deal, because it's made media around the world. And it's really exciting because studies have proven, you know, the Lancet, the WHO, all support DCRIM as a way of combating AIDS, HIV, and also to promote sex workers' safety, you know, because when you're not criminalized, you can go to the police, you can report assaults, you don't get kicked out of your homes. There's a lot of really good things about not being a criminal. So that's why SWAP supports it. And it's so the amnesty thing has given us a boost in the media where we get to talk about it like I can with you here. So that's really great.
Well, let's talk about different feminist strategies and politics around the issue of sex work or prostitution. As I understand it, sex work encompasses more sexually oriented services than prostitution, although these terms themselves are often contested. But many feminist organizations around the world support what sometimes is called the Swedish model or the Nordic model, that that has a kind of face appeal to it because it seems to separate sex workers as victims from perpetrators, and that that often is the name of feminism. What can you say a little about what the Nordic model is and what's problematic about it?
Yeah, of course. I love talking about this. So the Nordic model, or end demand as I called it, since it's also now in Canada and, you know, France is trying to do it, and so is Seattle actually. It's basically criminalizing the purchase of sex. Theoretically, you can't criminalize the purchase of something without also criminalizing the buyer. But in theory, what's so appealing about it is that prostitutes won't be arrested, in theory. So you have like stings where you set up, you know, a thing, and then when the client arrives, you know, you arrest him because he's buying sex, which is, you know, I understand the appeal, but if you think about it even a little bit, like, it goes out the window because it doesn't address the underlying economic reasons that people engage in sex work, which is that they need money. You know, one of the really big things when Canada implemented End Demand was that they were going to create a fund, an exit fund, to help sex workers leave the industry. And then it turned out to be too small to help anybody. They just did not put aside enough money for that. But the other thing is that you can't criminalize the purchase of something without also criminalizing the seller. So in Sweden, you know, sex workers still can't go to the police because their method of getting an income is still illegal. Incidences of rape have not actually gone down, assault against sex workers. And it also criminalizes the people they live with because it turns the people who, you know, like your mother, your boyfriend, your child, anyone who lives off of the income of sex work is suddenly a pimp or a trafficker. And that's really inconvenient. In Canada, it's so broad that actually if you take a taxi to a call, your taxi driver is also your pimp. So there's a lot of unthought of harm that this law has caused.
I mean, sexuality, and maybe not in all societies equally, but certainly our own society and history and many places in the world, it's very charged and carries many other anxieties that get loaded up onto women, and or women who explicitly negotiate around the sale of sexual services. And it seems to me that there is both this practical side of the issue, kind of harm production. How can we save women from this terrible work that women would only do if under coercive circumstances? Yeah. And there's kind of a pragmatic approach to it versus another approach that insists on sex work as being no more demeaning than many other forms of services sold for either wages or a fee. What is your position on that in terms of how you view the work itself or defend the work as work?
I have been in a lot of emotional labor jobs, and so I defend it as a caregiving job. You know, it's about the same as wiping the butt of a toddler or a grown adult if you're in, like, you know, one of those industries. And, you know, things that deal with body parts are sort of inherently stigmatized and feminized anyway.
And then sort of becomes dirty work. Maybe similar to being an abortionist, where something people do and then want to push aside or not think about it afterwards.
They're like, it's necessary, but we don't really support it. You know, it's a necessary evil. But sex work is also seen as a necessary evil, I guess, in some places, and then some places it's just a total evil.
Before closing today, I'd like you to say a little bit about the distinction between decriminalizing and legalizing sex work, because this is also an area where people are often quite confused about the distinction.
Yeah, it can be confusing. The way I like to explain it is that decriminalization means that you're just not a criminal for doing it, whereas legalization leaves some people out in the dust still as criminals. So in the U.S., we only have one state that legalizes it. That's Nevada. And anyone, you have to work in a brothel to be protected and to be abiding by the law. So you have to work in a trailer. Often you can't leave the premises. Half of your earnings go to your boss. And then anyone else who's not working in the brothel is a criminal. So anyone who doesn't want to give half of their money away is a criminal.
And so that's perhaps a distinction we should return to. Mm-hmm. And I think there are, it's a kind of a complicated debate.
Yeah.
But,
yes,
but the main point you're making today is in support of this Amnesty International position.
Yes.
And you're just in closing, say a little about how we can find out more about your work. And you have a new project we'll have you back on the show to talk about called
Awesome.
Stroll.
Yeah.
Just say a bit about how we can find out about your work in both of those projects.
Well, SWAP has a website. It's swappdx.org. And then there's also SWAP National. You can just Google SWAP National.
S-W-O-P.
Yeah, S-W-O-P. And then my side project is Stroll, which does harm reduction outreach among street workers in Portland. And that's strollpdx.org.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Talking with Red, with Portland activists working around the decriminalization of sex work.
Yeah, I so appreciate you having us in KBOO too, because big news outlets do not cover stories like this, only, you know, small community radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and support us, and by supporting KBOO, with your dollars.
Yeah.
You get quite a bit for this service.
Thanks, Jan and Red. Yes, we do get quite a bit for this service. And it is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. I want to thank our Old Mole contributors this morning. Old Mole's Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, Patsy Kohlberg, our engineer Joe Clement, and our guest Eric Larson, journalist, talking about Social Security. We heard from Red just now from SWAP, the Sex Workers Organizing Project, and we do this kind of thing frequently on our show. We like to cover territory that doesn't get covered often. And we like to keep folks up to date on what's going on in the world and how they can get involved. We're going to leave you this morning, though, with another opportunity to support KBOO by becoming a member. And so let's hear what Justin and Pear have to say.
Well, we're having a great morning. Thanks so much. And this has really been destination programming, exactly the kind of thing that people rely on KBOO to receive. And so we're hoping that people are moving to their phone right now, because it's never too late to get on board the mighty 90.7. Call us toll free at 877-500-5266. You can always do that online at KBOO.FM. I want to thank Joe in Southeast Portland who renewed. And I'm happy to report that KBOO got a raise today, because Joe gives, he gives 1 hour out 1 hour of his wage every month on an ongoing contribution. And he got a raise at work, so KBOO just got a raise. Fabulous, Joe. Thank you so much. Call us now and get on board. Toll free, 877-500-KBOO.
And we still have a few minutes left in our Double Your Money matching period. And generous anonymous donor has pledged he will double everything contributed up to $500, and we are keeping away. We are plugging away at that goal. We want you to give us a call, 877-500-5266. 5266. This is your radio station, folks. We are here for you, and we are part. You are part of us, and we are part of you. Thank you for that call. We want people to keep on calling. We are a self-sustaining community. We don't depend on outside donors or billionaires. We are we kind of fund ourselves, basically, when you think of the broader community. That's what keeps this station going on the air now for I don't know how many years, ever since 1968.
June 1968, we counted that we're at over 23 million commercial-free minutes and still counting.
Oh,
and
boy,
you know what?
That's
something, isn't it?
That's an accomplishment right there.
And imagine we did that with modest contributions of pennies, nickels, and dimes from thousands and thousands of people who make the choice to do the right thing. And, you know, I know there are a lot of organizations that are fighting to win some of your support. But let me ask you, if you could only support one organization, what kind of organization would it be? Would it bring you news and information you're not supposed to know that doesn't get done by other media sources? Would it have withstood the test of time, over 23 million commercial-free minutes and counting? Would it serve as an electronic bulletin board for all the social change activism going in the area and the region and indeed all over the world? Would it invite your participation at every level of the organization to fiddle with our knobs all the way up to joining the board of directors? Would it have a library of over 50,000 CDs and over 30,000 LPs? In short, my friends, would it be KBOO? Please say yes and call right now, toll free, 877-500-5266.
Well, let me say a little more about our record library, because I've had occasion to be in there looking when I was helping host the Radio Free Ireland, and we have a bulging record library because we have a kind of a bulging amount of music that we program. We're not a niche station, you know. We don't have this niche or that niche. We have all kinds of music, everything from Afropop to Zydeco. We do it all, and if our record library is so crammed with music that it's hard to navigate it, overflowing, and we are overflowing with music for you listeners out there. And we have music DJs who come here who know all about their kind of music. They bring their own CDs, so we have everything.
I call them our cultural ambassadors.
That's
and
right,
they,
yes.
Their expertise leads us on musical tours throughout the world. 877-500-5266. Para and I are standing on the shoulders of giants right now. So many people have shown generosity, and now we'd like to hear from you as well. 877-500-5266.
And I want to thank Martha from Northwest Portland, who is renewing. I want to thank Bill from Southeast Portland, who is renewing. Denise from Northeast Portland, renewing. Jay from North Portland, who is renewing, and Joe from Southeast Portland, who is increasing his monthly contribution.
That's
Thank
great. You
one
know,
and all.
I just wanted to mention, Joe upped his pledge. Now, up yours. 877-500-5266. I did notice we are so grateful for people continuing to renew their memberships, but it sounds to me like in that last batch, we didn't hear from too many new members, and it's really critical that we continue to widen the pie and add names to the KBOO Good Book. So we actually know that about 9 of every 10 who are listening right now and have been listening for years and rely on this programming haven't made that call. So imagine that. Look at what we have accomplished with only 10% of our listeners showing that support. Let's try and up that number. Maybe if you haven't made a call, try and remember how important this is. Remember that 83 of every 100 pennies that are in this building come from people just like you. Call us, 877-500-5266.
And come on down and see us at 20 Southeast 8th. We run a tight operation here, folks. We don't spend money lavishly. And we are sustaining this. We've been around now since 1968. The bad news is that other community stations are not doing so well because they let their budgets get out of control. They didn't get the contributions they expected. But KBOO has been, we've kind of been out there on the financial ocean now for ever since 1968 with your help, because you are part of KBOO and we are part of you. We are one big community, and we depend on each other to get the news from around the world that you don't hear anywhere else. So give us a call, 877-500-5266. 5266.
And you know, you can take some of this with you. Maybe you want to give some of this programming to people in your life. For a modest $75 gift over the year, you could start that at $6.25 a month. We'll send you a 4 gigabyte audio flash drive with talks from Naomi Klein, Judy Berry, W.E.B. Du Bois, Ward Churchill, Susan Faludi, Ken Kesey, Molly Ivins, Pete Seeger, and on and on and on. You know, the real gift is the quality of the signal you receive when you know that you help make it possible. That's how we do this, folks. So we want to thank everyone who has called in this morning and everyone who is moving to their phones, clicking over to KBOO.FM, and because you know we're doing what is left undone by others. The Old Mole Variety Hour is incomparable, and it's been a privilege, I know, for Per and I to pitch for it. Right now, we're going to get out of the way and start moving into Air Cascadia. Thank you all so much for moving to your phones right now and calling toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
Yes, and that is right. We will be moving toward Air Cascadia in just a few seconds. I want to let you know that at 10:15, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus with guest Joel Bourne, author of The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. And at 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with Anil Anaswamy about The Man Who Wasn't There, investigations into the strange new science of the self. And at 11:30 on the radio scene, Oregon writer Michael Hillquist talks about his new biography, Marie Ecke, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. So you're going to want to stay tuned to KBOO Portland for the rest of the day, at least the rest of the month.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline on Monday, September 14th at 6:30 p.m. to hear hosts Emma and Amy interview Lynn Stewart. Lynn Stewart is an activist, defense lawyer, breast cancer survivor, and a former political prisoner who has courageously stood up for the rights of revolutionaries, people of color, the poor, marginalized, and dispossessed for over 40 years. Join us as we chat with Lynn about her health, her time in prison, and the issues she is concerned with. That's Monday, September 14th at 6:30 p.m. on Prison Pipeline on KVU Community Radio at 90.7 FM.